I'm Tom Hall. It's the Midday News Wrap. Last summer, candidate Donald Trump was harshly criticized by the Gold Star family of Humayun Khan, who died in the line of duty in Iraq. On Tuesday night, an extended standing ovation for the wife of Navy SEAL Ryan Owens was the emotional high point of President Trump's address to Congress. The president was lauded for the moderate tone of his speech. Has Trump turned the corner, or will the recusal by Jeff Sessions be a harbinger of continued controversy? Speaking of controversy, there's plenty of it locally, too, from the Baltimore City Police Department to the Maryland House of Delegates. Jane Miller from WBAL Television, Farai Chidea from the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard, and the writer, activist, and scholar Dr. K. Wise Whitehead join me to go behind the big stories of the week. The Midday News Wrap starts right after these headlines. And welcome to the Midday News Wrap, everybody. Very glad you're with us. I'm Tom Hall. President Trump gave a widely praised speech on Tuesday night to a joint session of Congress. Various news outlets have identified more than a dozen false or misleading statements in that address. The Washington Post is keeping track of such things. They've accumulated 187 factually inaccurate statements made by the president in his first 40 days in office. Still, many people think that the president quieted skeptics with his performance in front of Congress. Jeff Sessions recused himself from investigating contacts between the Trump campaign and Russian diplomats and operatives during the campaign. He didn't say anything about recusing himself from investigating contacts that may have occurred after the election. For the moment, Republicans are relieved, but Democrats are demanding that Sessions resign. The person who would take over any investigation of the Russian contacts would be the Deputy Attorney General, and President Trump has nominated the current U.S. Attorney for Maryland, Rod Rosenstein, for that position. His confirmation hearing is scheduled for Tuesday. Last Wednesday, a couple days ago, Rosenstein announced the indictment of seven Baltimore City police officers on racketeering charges, including allegations that the officers extorted money from witnesses, stole money that was acquired in raids, and filed fake overtime claims. The officers were part of an elite unit in charge of getting guns off the street. Five of the seven are in jail today, having been denied bail yesterday. And in the Maryland General Assembly, Delegate Dan Morheim is facing a vote of reprimand today as we speak in the Assembly for ethics violations. On the News Wrap panel today, Farai Chidea is a journalist and fellow at the Harvard Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at the Kennedy School of Government. She's also the author of The Episodic Career, How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption. She joins us on the line from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome back to the show, Farai. Good to talk to you.
Always great. Thank you.
Jane Miller joins us here in Studio A. She's the award-winning lead investigative reporter at WBAL Television. Hey, Jane.
Hey, Tom.
And Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. She's an associate professor of communications and African and African American studies at Loyola University, Maryland, and the founding executive director of the Emily Frances Davis Center for Education, Research, and Culture. She's also the author of several books, including Letters to My Black Sons, Raising Boys in a Post-Racial America. Dr. K., always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure for me as well. Thank you.
So, Farai Chidea, let's start with you. The speech that Mr. Trump gave the other day, what was your take on that?
Well, I think that there's a huge difference between what is presidential seeming and what is actually good politics and policy. And there was such a sense of relief, not just from Republicans, but also from people like Van Jones, who, you know, hardly is identified with the political right, that President Trump was looking presidential. But I think that we just have so many bigger problems, as the rest of the week exemplified, particularly, you know, I know that we're going to get to Sessions, so I won't go into it. But I think that we have to keep our eye on the ball. And the ball has always been, what is American governance, and how do we proceed in a way that actually allows us to grow and to be, you know, to flourish as a country. And I don't think that this speech got us anywhere near that. And there was still so much rhetoric about an era of greatness beginning, and I'm quoting directly, our neglected inner cities will see a rebirth of hope, safety, and opportunity. I would love to believe that, but I see no evidence.
Jane Miller, you've covered a lot of politicians in your time.
I've been thinking about that lately.
Yeah.
I mean, how many?
This whole notion of acting presidential.
Oh, like, no, Tom, look, I was so amused watching the morning shows on Wednesday morning. I said, okay, this is what it's going to be before I turn it on. Oh, he had such a great tone. Tone, tone, tone. And it's like, you know, come on. I mean, Reagan had many of the same policies, but he said them more nicely, right? So, come on. I mean, I don't know what's going on with journalists by and large in these days, because I absolutely agree. You've got to keep your eye on the ball here, and it's easy to get distracted by someone's antics, which is what Trump is really good at, is antics. He's a performer. He's an entertainer. That's what he does. And his the vitriol that he was spewing over the campaign trail is partially what got him elected. I think the one observation I had is the guy we saw on Tuesday night is not the guy that his supporters elected.
Indeed. And Kay Whitehead, this notion that anything the president says can be believed on its face is also has to be called into question, because he has either changed his mind or said stuff that's patently untrue so many times. It's really difficult, regardless of the tone, when you listen to the actual statements, to know whether or not, number one, he believes them, and number two, it's true. I mean, they figure it out eventually, you know, within 24 hours, we know whether or not it's actually factually true. But there is this credibility issue with this president.
I think this president has very little credibility. I think that what is interesting is that our expectations were so low that simply reading from the teleprompter was enough to, quote, look presidential. The bar used to be so much higher. I think thanks to the citizen journalist, and I love the way the internet gets so actively involved in these statements now, right? So people are tweeting live. They're on Facebook Live.
And professional journalists
as well. But the idea is that nothing is taken at face value anymore. You used to hear the president speak and you would believe him until you read something different. Now you're fact-checking along with everyone else. Every time you made a statement, I was Googling very quickly to find out whether it was the truth. It wasn't whether it was starting at the truth and whether it was a lie. I believed it was a lie, and I'm trying to find out whether it was the truth.
Farhad Chaudhry, let me have you react a little bit to at least the part of the speech that really, really upset me. And this was this emotional moment that was had with the wife of the Navy SEAL who was killed in the raid in Yemen. This is a little bit of that part of the speech.
We are blessed to be joined tonight by Corinne Owens, the widow of U.S. Navy Special Operator, Senior Chief William Ryan Owens. Ryan died as he lived, a warrior and a hero, battling against terrorism and securing our nation. I just spoke to our great General Mattis, just now, who reconfirmed that, and I quote, Ryan was a part of a highly successful raid that generated large amounts of vital intelligence that will lead to many more victories in the future against our enemy. Ryan's legacy is etched into eternity. Thank you.
And what followed was an extended ovation. Farhad Chaudhry, I mean, hearing the president talk like that, in light of what he had to say as recently as last October about another Gold Star hero, Humayun Khan, who was a Muslim American captain in the army killed in Iraq, that struck me as just cynical and surprising. How did it strike you?
Well, first of all, there's just the facts about the raid. I live in a neighborhood in Brooklyn. I'm based in Boston right now for an academic fellowship, but I live in a neighborhood in Brooklyn, New York, usually, with a lot of Yemeni shopkeepers. And there was actually a protest in New York just by Yemeni bodega owners. There's that many of them. And Yemen has been a extremely difficult theater of operations for the U.S. military, and the raid, the death of this Navy SEAL is one that produced no intelligence. So this man died, which is a tragedy, but there was nothing that the U.S. gained from it. There's some evidence that the Trump administration mistimed the raid and went ahead when it had information that it should have waited that would have made it safer. And a child died in the raid, which is unfortunately not that uncommon for children and women who are non-combatants to have, you know, to die in these raids. So the whole idea of stating that this was a policy success, I mean, you can, the sacrifice is one thing. You know, this man is dead, and he died serving his country. But to raise this up as something that was a triumph of the Trump administration is extremely problematic top to bottom. And that, to me, is the larger frame. Like, it gets back to these Orwellian senses. Like, to call failure victory, to me, is much more problematic. I mean, honoring someone who died for their country is very important, but the way that this was framed was very Orwellian.
And Jane Miller, I'll tell you,
I felt the same thing. I felt, and I don't mean to be, I don't want to use the wrong phrase here, but please understand the way I'm going to say this. I felt he was using a human shield.
Yeah.
That Ms. Owens was obviously in a, I mean, think about it. I mean,
in an unimaginable state of grief.
And here she is being used as a prop in the floor of the Congress. And it would be one thing if it was just recognizing her and her husband's service to his country. But then to throw in that statement about just talk to the great General Mattis and this was da-da-da-da-da without...
And 10 senior
and here's
Pentagon
this woman,
officials
here's this guy's father who's
statement.
Demanding an investigation.
Right.
So it just... It's uncomfortable. I was very uncomfortable. I feel horrible pain for this woman and then to be so publicly displayed and obviously for the purpose... I have no other conclusion than the president did this for the purpose of saying this was a successful operation, period, end of story, and using her grief and her as this human shield.
Yeah, it did seem incredibly exploitative. Kate Whitehead, he also said, and this is a phrase he's repeated several times from the campaign through his election, that my job is not to represent the world, it's to represent the United States of America. So he's purporting a dramatic change in American foreign policy towards isolationism, nationalism, that really represents a remarkable turn from where the country has placed itself in geopolitically for a long time.
What I appreciate is that people are pushing back against this. So as Donald Trump kind of places himself to only represent the United States of America, in his mind, a place that is isolated, a place that acts alone, a place that is not concerned with playing well with others, there is a pushback that's happening at the same time. People are protesting. They are speaking out. We're seeing a level of activism that is running rampant through the country and really around the world in response to these type of statements that people understand that this is not the America that we want to be. It does not represent how we've grown. It doesn't represent how we've changed. It doesn't represent how hard we're working to be better, that we don't want to get pulled back. There's a small portion, of course, that support this notion that we have to stand alone as we did a very long time ago. I mean, when you think about watching 13th and seeing kind of the words of Donald Trump against the images from the civil rights movement, that's not the world we want to go through anymore.
Yeah, 13th, the great documentary by
yes.
Ava DuVernay. Yeah.
Which gives a great look at just kind of putting his words on screen as a law and order candidate and then juxtaposing that with images from the civil rights movement. It reminds you that that's a world we used to live in, the world we fought to come out of, and we don't want to go back there.
Kay Wise Whitehead is an associate professor of communication in African and African American studies at Loyola University, Maryland, here in Baltimore. Jane Miller is the lead investigative reporter at WBAL Television. Farai Chidea joins us from Cambridge, Massachusetts, where she is a journalist and fellow at Harvard's Shorenstein Center. More Midday News Wrap after a break. 410-662-8780 is how you can join the conversation. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. We'll be right back. Stick around. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on the program Monday, with Russia so much in the news, a new book looks at the geopolitical significance of the Russian Revolution 100 years ago. Will England joins me to talk about that book. March 1917, On the Brink of War and Revolution. He's an editor at the Washington Post. On the foreign desk, he has also served as a Moscow correspondent on three different shifts, two for the Washington Post and one for the Baltimore Sun. If you're just joining us today, it's the Midday News Wrap. Joining us on the line from Cambridge, Massachusetts, is Farai Chidea. She's a journalist and fellow at Harvard University's Shorenstein Center for Media, Politics, and Public Policy. And I'm joined here in the studio by Jane Miller, the award-winning lead investigative reporter at WBAL-TV, and Dr. Kay Wise Whitehead of Loyola University. She's the founding executive director of the Emily Francis Center for Education, Research, and Culture. You are welcome to join our conversation here on the News Wrap. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Farai Chidea, let's hear a little bit of Attorney General Jeff Sessions' remarks yesterday.
I have now decided to recuse myself from any existing or future investigations of any matter relating in any way to the campaigns for President of the United States.
So, Farai, do you take any notice of the fact that he talks about for the campaign for President of the United States, meaning anything that happened after the election? For example, what happened with General Flynn after the election and the contacts that he had with the Russian ambassador between Election Day and Inauguration Day? Is that nitpicking and being semantic, or is that a significant distinction?
Well, I think that everything has become, a game of words in politics right now. Perhaps that's always the case, but, you know, Sessions in recusing himself but not stepping down from his position essentially is saying, well, I answered as well as I could, but you're putting me in a box. And I think that the reality is that in most normal political environments, this would have been seen as a much more massive issue than it is, and he would have immediately been asked to step aside, not just from this one investigation, but out of the entire role. And so I definitely would be very careful, I think, moving forward, and this should be true, I think, on both sides of the aisle, for reporters speaking to Democrats and Republicans and for Democrats and Republicans speaking to each other in committees and on Capitol Hill. It reminds me almost in a way of that impeachment era statement that Bill Clinton made, you know, about what the definition of is. You know, we're really at that point where we have to ask people to clarify every little thing that they've done. And it's clear, from what I understand, Sessions was very much dissembling when he gave his testimony in the hearings to become Attorney General. And I think from now on, both reporters and people in politics have to really ask him what the meaning of is every time he makes a statement. And it's unfortunate that we've reached this point, but it's astounding to me. I mean, I'm of an age where I grew up paying attention to the Cold War, and literally at one point, one of my friends called me and just told me that she loved me if we were going to get nuked. It's the kind of thing where kids actually worry about this stuff, you know, or did when I was a kid, you know, like that we worried that the Cold War would just kill us. And now we're at a point where very legitimate lines of inquiry about whether the U.S. elections were tampered with are being shoved aside for partisan reasons, as far as I can tell, and I find it extremely disturbing. I don't think that the geopolitics should keep us up at night in the sense of, well, we're all going to die. But there's any time that you can have a potentially compromised U.S. election, and not just that, but have entire segments of the federal government poo-pooing it, there's something going on that we should be extremely disturbed by. So I guess what I'm saying in summary is that I think from now on, Sessions has to be watched like a hawk for every single thing he says and for his actions as well.
Jane Miller, Senator Leahy, who was part of the committee to confirm Mr. Sessions, sent written questions. One of those questions was, have you been in contact with anyone connected to any part of the Russian government about the 2016 election, either before or after Election Day? And Sessions answered no.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday, he said yes.
Mm-hmm.
Is that
sure
perjury?
Yes.
I mean, neither of us are lawyers, but what do you think?
Well, I think that to emphasize that we are in this hyper-partisan. So what may be a foul to one side is not to the other. But there's a much larger problem here, and that is that the leadership structure in Washington for the balance of power is completely broken down. I mean, if this was, Watergate wasn't exactly a stellar performance by everybody, but Howard Baker certainly came around. And I mean, it turned out to be the legislature during Watergate proved to be a strong measure of checks and balances. It conducted the hearings. It was revealing. It obviously led ultimately to the resignation of Nixon. You look around in Washington, and I mean, I said this on my social media feed. If Washington worked, and this is before Sessions, did what he did yesterday, but when this whole issue came up about whether he had been truthful about, what exactly did he do? Was he truthful about it? If Washington worked, Mitch McConnell would have the you-know-what to talk to Chuck Schumer and say, let's have a bipartisan investigation, select committee that's going to, ferret this out. But that is not what happens. It gets whatever side is in the minority is pushing for full-scale investigation, and the side that's in the majority is like, oh, this is no big deal. Let's move on.
Right. Kay Whitehead, you talk about, how people are trying to hold these folks' feet to the fire, trying to, fact check them and stuff. You're an activist. I mean, do you think that the activist community has any faith in the political leaders, the actual elected leaders, doing what Jane is suggesting?
Absolutely not. There is no faith that the political leadership, the one that's existing now in Washington, which has become what we call the new normal, because people often say, well, under normal circumstances, this would happen, and this used to happen. Well, this is the new normal. Coming down from the White House, that there's always an element to what the person is saying that just does not ring true. And you feel that something is wrong. You feel there's a lie brewing. And then later you find out there was a lie happening. And then there's a backstep. And then there's a turn of the story. And you're made to feel that you're wrong for pointing out the lie. So there's absolutely no trust in the political leadership. And I think that even though, to what Farai said earlier, even though kids are not up wondering whether we're going to get nuked, they are talking about what's happening in Washington. I'm finding conversations among 7-year-olds and 9-year-olds and 12-year-olds in ways I've never seen before, where they're talking about what is happening with the president, what's changing in Washington, what they can do, and they're feeling afraid in different ways. If they are from an immigrant community, there's a fear that their door is going to be kicked in and they're going to be dragged out and deported. So there's another fear that's happening now.
I was at a Read Across America event yesterday at Leith Walk Elementary School in Northeast Baltimore, second graders, 26 second graders. We went to questions and answers. What about Mr. Trump? What about covering Mr. Trump?
Yes. Yeah.
The second graders.
Yeah, second grade,
okay.
Yeah.
So
it's on the radar.
Kay's point, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
For
Ichidea, it's interesting. There's a piece in the Times Wednesday that talked about the fact that the Obama administration, during their last days, they did a bit of scrambling to make sure that the intel that had been collected about Russian involvement in the elections was disseminated within the administration in a way that would guard against the Trump administration suppressing that information.
Leaving footprints.
They were leaving, yes, footprints. They were trying to guard against the possibility of some of this information being disposed of or whitewashed. What do you make of that? I mean, it sounds like the Obama administration was worried and also expecting some sort of investigation moving forward.
Absolutely. And it reminds me of a larger conversation I had with some other political reporters, and we were discussing presidential transition teams. And I said that, well, when it's a friendly transfer, from one within one party or from one president to another, and there's a level of respect. Presidential transitions are like, you know, here's how you work the coffee maker, here's how you do this, this, you know, and on all the way up to, you know, here's how you use the nuclear codes. And if not, it's like hiding the silverware. It's like, oh my gosh, the barbarians are coming. We're gonna, like, you know, hide all the important stuff, and then.
Right. Well, the Clintons were accused of taking the W's off of the computers. You know?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I would not be surprised if the Obama administration still has a footprint in government. Of course, there are many political appointees who transition, but there's a number of people who are career staffers and who disagree with this administration, and there's a number of private message boards for people in civil service. And I think the Trump administration is worried and should be worried that some of the people working indirectly for the administration, and as we can see, even directly through the leaks that have been going on, are not fans of this administration. So I wouldn't be surprised if not only was there stuff that happened in the past with the administration kind of sending around information to people who could carry the ball forward, but there are also people who are still in government who really are disturbed by not just the questions about Russia, but other aspects of the president's policies. And it will be a very interesting coming years, because there are people working in the federal government who oppose the administration.
Let's go to the phones. We have a call from Dan, who's no longer on the line, but he left a message. He said that he's grateful that Mr. Trump is being called out on his exploitation of Corinne Owens at the joint address to the joint session of Congress. We'll go to Clarence in New Freedom, Pennsylvania. Welcome to the Midday News Wrap, Clarence.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your program. I watched the other night, I'm not even going to call it a speech, and what we need to do as Americans, we need to understand that no matter what goes on, this term presidential, he's never going to be there. I'm a veteran. I served in the United States Army from 1968-71 during Vietnam. I'm sitting here now watching, looking at my father's flag from World War II. Mm. And he used this woman. And from what I understand, I don't know whether it was earlier in the day or the day before, but he was on Fox, and he blamed the generals for what went wrong in that mission. If you look at this administration, starting at the top from him to a lot of his appointees, I watched a lot of confirmation hearings, including Jeff Sessions. He lied, and there's no way to get around it. We want to make, while they did this, no, it was a lie. And evidently in this administration, it's okay to do that. And as a 68-year-old African-American of this country, an American, I'm appalled that we have someone sitting in that seat. And I thank you all for listening to my comment.
Well, thank you.
Ms. Miller, keep doing what you're doing in Baltimore.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Don't worry.
Well, thank you for your call, sir, and thank you for your service and that of your father as well. When we talk about the loyal opposition, Jane Miller, Tom Perez, who was part of the O'Malley administration here in Maryland, went
How about
on to,
that?
To work
Martin O'Malley tried to be president. But his cabinet member's now head of the DNC.
So he's, you know, he was at the Justice Department for a while, and then Labor Secretary under the Obama administration, and now he won a very close, hotly contested thing, a lot of candidates. What do you make of that move? I mean, here we have the Democrats reelecting Nancy Pelosi as the leader of the caucus, eschewing the opportunity
Dems
go
are taking a lot of heat for their
younger
response on Tuesday night by using the former governor of Kentucky.
Yes.
It's like the Democrats want to put one foot in the water of change, and not the other. I don't know. I don't know. I think the jury's out on what happens. I do know this, that if you look across the country, what the Democratic Party needs to do is exactly what the Republican Party did in terms of balance of power, and that is work on local races, work on local races, work on local races. Yeah. And the president thing will come as it needs to, but you know, there 35 governors are Republican. I mean, the legislature is a They're just a, it's a huge red map. And so that's where they need to focus. And I don't know. It's an interesting, it's just an interesting party at the moment. There's this real tug going on. And, you know, the naming of Keith Ellison as the vice chair. I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay, what do you think? I'm really curious, too.
I don't know. I feel like the Democratic Party, that there's a learning curve, but they're not learning fast enough, that they tend to move forward and then they move backwards. And I don't understand why they're not realizing that they have a real divide between where they sit as politicians and where their base sits, that people don't put a lot of trust in that they know what they're doing. So bringing Keith Ellison up, trying to unite the party in that way and wearing each other's pins at some point to show us that they are working together, there's still this sense that they don't know what they're going to do, and that the real calls for now mobilizing third and fourth very powerful independent parties, that call is real because people don't see the Democratic base as being their answer anymore.
Well, now they're going to have this debate about, do we have to go after those white rural voters, you know, some of whom used to be in the Democratic Party,
yes.
But...
the ones who Mr. Trump refers to as the forgotten Americans who will never be forgotten
correct.
Again.
And that's a slippery slope because if you do that, then you are essentially going to further ostracize.
Alienate
those who feel
alienated.
Right. Yeah. Exactly right.
So Farai Chidea,
how I think about it, and I agree with you, by the way, but I think that there has to be an effort. I mean, part of my work during this campaign season was to do a series called The Voters. So I would go to places like Warren, Ohio, where a record number of Democratic voters switched to the Republican Party to vote either for or against, mainly for, Donald Trump on primary day because you can change your registration there. So I talked to a lot of, you know, hardcore Trump voters there. I talked to an African-American millennial in the swing state of North Carolina who was not impressed with Clinton and ended up voting third party, on and on and on. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of information that we still need on how different constituencies view their interests. So before the Democratic Party can go about trying to either message to working-class white Americans or figure out how that fits in with the traditional or today's Democratic base, which tends to be heavily people of color, I think there has to be a process of investigation of what different communities want and how they can work together. So I think about the whole phrase, the political slogan, better together. That's aspirational, but I think some people think, no, better apart. Right. And if that's the perception...
That's the way the polling looks, too.
Well, Clinton's phrase was stronger together, too. And
stronger together, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But maybe we're stronger apart. Yeah. And Farai,
it's perception.
Sure.
It's a question of perception, and we need to know how people really feel. I don't think there's been enough investigation, mm-hmm. and there's been a papering over of long simmering resentments, which only now the party is starting to look at.
Right.
So, Farai, we're going to lose you in just a couple minutes. So before that happens, I want you to respond to an email we've gotten from Christopher, who talks about Trump's photo op with the presidents of historically black colleges earlier this week. He signed an executive order. And, of course, Christopher comments that signing this executive order doesn't add a dime to the budgets, but it allows Trump to claim that he's done more than Obama did for HBCUs. He says, it's clear to me that Trump's administration will make a serious effort to pry African Americans away from the Democratic Party. He says Trump's prominent placement of African Americans among the victims of crimes committed by illegal immigrants at the joint session is a bald-faced play to stoke racial resentment against Latinos. Mm-hmm. He says, I'd like to think that African Americans wouldn't be swayed by such gestures, but after seeing populism flourish, I'm doubtful. Mm-hmm. What do you think? You write a lot about race and politics and that intersection. How does that strike you, Farai?
I actually, that's not what I would be concerned about in the sense that you saw, like Donald Trump as a candidate deliberately avoided attacking African Americans. He sort of couched everything as, I want to help you, you have these terrible communities, which of course a lot of black people were like, you know, you have no idea how I live.
Yeah.
But
what do
but
you have to lose?
Right. It's this idea that he was courting black Americans and demonizing Mexican-Americans and Muslims. But black Americans didn't fall for that as a strategy because I think there's a lot of knowledge of all of the coded ways that race works, and that the appeals to Black Americans were mainly meant to make white voters feel better. So I actually wouldn't be too worried about that, but I do think that there is, I do think that, that basically the strategy of demonizing immigrants and Mexican Americans has worked more broadly. I just don't think that Black Americans are the target of that courtship, nor do we see evidence that Black Americans are the ones responding to that courtship.
Farai Chidea is a journalist and fellow at Harvard's Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at the Kennedy School of Government up in Cambridge, where she's joined us on the phone. She's also the author of The Episodic Career, How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption. Farai, thank you so much. I look forward to the next time. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Kay Wise Whitehead will stay with us here in the studio along with Jane Miller. Kay is from Loyola University, Maryland. Jane, of course, is the lead investigative reporter at WBAL Television. If you'd like to join our conversation, we're going to shift our focus to some local stories. 410-662-8780 is our number here at Midday. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. We're glad you're with us. Stick around. And welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. It's the Midday News Wrap, a thing that we do most Fridays. Jane Miller is the lead investigative reporter for WBAL-TV. Kay Wise Whitehead is an activist, writer, and professor at Loyola University, Maryland. They're with me here in Studio A. You are welcome to join our conversation. 410-662-8780 is the number. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. I want to shift now and go to the phones and talk to Erin Cox. She is the State House Bureau Chief for the Baltimore Sun, and she has been in the House of Delegates today where, according to her and Rachel Bay, our reporter for WIPR, the House has just passed a resolution recommending a reprimand for Delegate Dan Morheim of Baltimore County. Erin, welcome back. How you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Great. So the vote means what? What did it say? And what's the next step, if there is one?
So this is the final step in a disciplinary process. The vote was 138-0-1. Dan Morheim did not vote on whether or not to punish himself. And the vote was an adoption of a committee report and a resolution saying that he broke the spirit of Maryland's ethics laws when he advocated for policies for the medical marijuana industry without disclosing sufficiently that he had been employed by a marijuana company trying to get a medical marijuana license to grow, process, and dispense the drug.
And the reprimand, it's this resolution that says, okay, you are now reprimanded. Does it mean anything else? I mean, he's already lost his leadership position. He's lost his seat on the health policy committee. Are there other actions that the leadership in the House can take at this point based on this reprimand, or is this just it?
This is it. I mean, they read aloud an accounting of his actions and how the ethics committee found that deficient. It was about a 7-minute long process. So Morheim had to sit there and basically be publicly shamed. He has suggested that he thinks it's not quite fair to be accused of breaking a spirit of law instead of the letter of the law. And in his 3-page kind of defense apology that he issued yesterday, he suggested that maybe we should change the laws to make clear the lines that lawmakers are supposed to follow. Now, that's something that not everybody here in the General Assembly agrees with. I just spoke with the Speaker of the House, Michael Bush, who said there are certain lines that people should know not to step across.
Governor Hogan gave a press conference earlier this morning, about 3 hours ago. This is one of the things he had to say about Mr. Morheim.
I got to tell you, I was disappointed in the lack of action on behalf of the on the part of the legislature. There's no question in my mind that what was done was completely unethical, and in my opinion, somebody who has such complete disregard for the ethics laws of Maryland should be removed from office rather than slapped on the wrist. It seems like they always want to sweep things under the rug and not take real action. But in my opinion, it actually shows the need for our ethics legislation.
So, Aaron Cox, we're going to let you go because I know you're busy, but is there any chance that there's going to be ethics reform in this session of the Assembly?
There's always a chance. I don't think it's at the top priority of the legislature. The ethics reforms that were introduced were pushed by the governor and are tinged with a sense of partisanship. And I haven't seen a lot of willingness of Maryland Democrats to kind of carry forward the mantle for Governor Hogan, as he's calling, saying that Annapolis is full of corruption. They haven't really been eager to agree with him on that point. But anything's possible. We still have a lot of time left in the session, and it may move forward.
Well, Aaron Cox, appreciate your taking the time this afternoon and appreciate your reporting on this. Have a great weekend. Thanks.
Thanks. You too.
Aaron Cox is the State House Bureau Chief for the Baltimore Sun. Jane Miller, you've been covering another bit of public corruption, a big story.
A little bit.
Just a touch. A tincture of public corruption in the Baltimore Police Department. Seven officers indicted by the same gentleman who now may become the Deputy Attorney General who would be charged with looking into the Russia connection in the election. Rod Rosenstein, what does the indictment allege?
Well, the indictment alleges that these seven officers who are part of an elite gun task force used their power to essentially rob people of money and other valuables after arresting them in some cases for no reason, lying on police reports, lying in affidavits, lying about their overtime. And I think this case comes as I'm always looking at the bigger picture. I mean, they've had overtime problems in that department for a really long time. And they still haven't gotten a handle on it. They spend $42 million a year in the last couple of years. Before that, it was like $38, $39 million. But it's a blank check every year. And now comes an allegation that some of these officers in this case are bragging on wiretaps, oh, we're making $8,000, $10,000 a month in fraudulent overtime. So, and it's like silence at City Hall. I'm amazed that the mayor did not hold a news conference the day of the announcement of the indictment at 4 o'clock. That was at like whatever time. And 4 o'clock, she doesn't hold a news conference and say, I want an immediate audit of the Baltimore City Police Department. What is this?
And the commissioner did, Commissioner Davis did make mention of the possibility of an audit coming up. Mm-hmm. It is one of the things that this indictment appears to expose is how easy it is
to get away with
for
it.
Baltimore cops to cheat on their overtime, regardless of the other cheating
that
they might
and
have
also
done.
The lack of oversight on. Here's the problem. Every commissioner, for as long as I've been in town, loves these specialized units. You can call them what you want. The Violent Crime Task Force, back in the 80s, it was the Stop Squad. Violent Crime Impact Division under Bielefeld. They're all the same thing.
Because we always hear about getting guns off the streets.
Correct.
And this was the unit charged with doing just that.
These are officers who operate in plain clothes. They operate with a lot of freedom.
Yep.
And I know officers that Joe Crystal, who is obviously the whistleblower, he operated in one of these units and has a lot of knowledge of them. And so the question is, if you have good supervision throughout the department and good training and good leadership and good accountability measures, you can operate with these units. But if you don't, they become rogue units. And that's what's happened. You've got guys making overtime sitting on vacation. Who's signing this? There's a lot we don't know about this case. Who's signing all these overtime slips? How is this possible? Who's looking at the charging documents that get written that may not look right? You know, are they using the same language, charging document to charging document to charging document, which is a way you do it if you're, faking it up instead of really, doing the case? I mean, this case exposes enormous questions, all in the face of the Department of Justice investigation.
And a consent decree.
Absolutely. Yeah. This is all going on at the same time.
And, of course, we have to mention that these officers are innocent until proven guilty, but there's wiretaps, there's video surveillance. There's a whole lot of information that is certainly very
damning. One of my Twitter followers this week said, so I guess when we hear people in the African-American community say, this cop did this to me, we ought to listen. And I'm like,
finally,
no kidding.
Very
few reporters have been listening for a long time, and that's really important because when you have powerful institutions like a police department, where do people go to be heard? And that's the same issue today as it's been for 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and 20 years ago.
So Kay Whitehead, and just as an aside, because it always race always matters. I don't know how it matters here, but five of these officers are African American, two of them are white. But when you hear the Justice Department ferreting out this corruption, this alleged corruption, and going after it, does that will this serve to buoy and assure people in the African American community that, you know, people really are trying to police the police, that they're trying to weed out these bad apples that we've been hearing about ever since the uprising in 2015?
Well, I'm going to unpack that and kind of answer it in two ways. One is that there are people within the African American community, and of course I don't look to speak for all of them, but in the communities where I've visited and I've had conversations, we have been saying this for a long time, that there has been corruption taking place, that you do have these rogue officers, that when people are afraid, the police is not the first person you call, because the police shows up and you might get arrested, you might get beat down, you might get attacked. And it's been happening and running rampant in Baltimore City. We've been talking about it under Freddie Gray. Nobody believed people. They thought we were overreaching. They thought we were making things up. It couldn't be as bad as you thought. No, these black cops are from the community. They're a part of this world. It's like, no, there's still some rogue cops out here. And you need to talk about how serious the blue wall really is and how removed that is from the community. And then the second piece, in terms of, you know, race kind of getting involved in all this, I think race is always a factor. Unfortunately, living in America and growing up in America, we've been socialized under this cloud of race. It always comes up, and it only serves to remind us it doesn't matter the color of the police officer. It matters the way they use their power and their force in certain communities. That when you have black police officers going into white communities, sometimes the behavior is different. I don't paint all police with a broad stroke, but sometimes the behavior is different. You do things in the black community that you may not necessarily do, say, in Mount Washington. You may not necessarily do, say, in Fells Point, that you might do in East Baltimore. Someone sitting outside, you might chase them, knock them down, break their spine in ways you would do in East Baltimore that you wouldn't even do in Fells Point. You might enact a curfew on the city that only gets really pushed in East Baltimore, and we're walking around in Hamden, and we're walking around on Charles Street without this curfew. We know that there are two different Baltimores, and we're only finding this out more because finally people are starting to listen. Perhaps if you had listened before when we talked about setting up a civilian review board so that cops are not reviewing cops, then we wouldn't have gotten this far along. You'd have civilians sitting there saying, there's something wrong with these papers. Does anyone see the numbers don't add up? But when cops are reviewing cops, we wonder if everybody's getting paid off.
Yeah, this investigation, yeah. Jay Miller, has gone on for quite some time. Yeah. This was not one of these things that they just started listening in 3 weeks ago.
Yes, correct.
And the implications on the criminal justice system are enormous. Dramatic. I mean, Marilyn Mosby's already sort of quietly dismissed perhaps as many as 4 or 5 cases that involve these cops.
There will be cases dismissed every day for some time.
Because the credibility of these particular police officers will no longer be trusted, and therefore they can't use them.
Well, and there's going to be defense lawyers that go back in time and say, wait a minute.
What about my guy?
Yeah, what about this case? It's not the first time. This has landed with a big splash, but we've had overtime, fraudulent overtime allegations for a long time. We have had these kinds of, I've done many stories on exactly this kind of rogue behavior in the police department that did not result in this kind of criminal indictment.
That is all the time we have. Kay Whitehead, Jane Miller, I appreciate both you guys coming by. Have a wonderful weekend, and thank you so much. Sorry I didn't get to everybody on the phone, but thank you so much. We'll see you soon.
Thanks, Tom.
Anytime.
Jane Miller is the award-winning lead investigative reporter at WBAL Television. KY's Whitehead, an associate professor of communications in African and African-American studies at Loyola University, Maryland. She's the founding executive director of the Emily Frances Davis Center for Education, Research, and Culture. She's written a whole bunch of books. One of the very good ones is called Letters to My Black Sons, Raising Boys in a Post-Racial America. We got links to more information on the web, wypr.org/midday. Coming up on the program Monday, a conversation with Washington Post Foreign Desk editor Will England about his new book that chronicles the Russian Revolution. It's called March 1917, On the Brink of War and Revolution. I want to thank Two Boots Pizza for lunch today. They are located on Mount Royal Avenue near Mica, and they offer creative and traditional New York pizzas with a New Orleans twist for on-site dining, catering, and delivery. You can find them online, twoboots.com.
MiddayNewsWrap.com. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknall. The show's produced by Rob Sivak, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill. Austin Coghlan from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. Charlie Hines provides production assistance. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.